Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Climate change is one of the most pressing issues facing humanity today. Understanding and responding to climate change has also become one of the most divisive issues in our culture. It's become a political lightning rod, and the schism between the scientific community and those who believe in the work of scientists and those who do not is deep. Catherine Hayhoe is an atmospheric scientist who studies climate change. Catherine has served as the lead author for the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th U.S. National Climate Assessments. She hosts the PBS digital series Global Weirding, Climate, Politics, and Religion. And she's on a personal mission to change the conversation about climate change and to bridge the gap between scientists and Christians. She's coming to Iowa this week. She'll be giving the Aldo Leopold Distinguished Lecture at the University of Northern Iowa Thursday evening at 7. She'll be giving the keynote luncheon address at the Growing Sustainable Communities Conference in Dubuque on Friday. And then on Saturday, she'll be in Hiawatha as part of Called to Climate Action, a statewide interfaith gathering. She is with me now. Hello, Catherine.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And, you know, climate change is not a new concept. It's something we've known about for a long time. And for a long time, it was not actually considered to be a controversial concept. Mm-hmm. Do you remember when you first realized that it had become a controversial subject?
Yes. Well, people are often surprised to realize that we've known since the 1850s that digging up and burning coal and gas and oil produces heat-trapping gases that are wrapping an extra blanket around our planet. And we first were able to measure the warming of the planet in the 1930s. So this is a really old science, and it has not been controversial for decades, even over 100 years. Until when? Until we started talking about solutions. Because a thermometer is not Democrat or Republican. It doesn't give us a different number depending on how we vote. But the solutions are very political, and there are solutions across the whole political spectrum. That's an important thing we want to get into. But most people categorize the solutions as only belonging to the left-hand side of the spectrum. But rather than saying it's a real problem and I don't want to fix it, our defense mechanism is to say it can't be a real problem. Because otherwise, I would be a bad person if it was a real problem and I didn't want to fix it.
What led you to the study of climate change?
Well, growing up in Canada myself, you learn about climate change in school, and I kind of felt like, well, the grass is green, the sky is blue, and climate is changing due to human activities. But I had mentally lumped it, as many of us do, with environmental issues. So air pollution, deforestation, biodiversity loss, climate change, things that people who are environmentalists care about, and I certainly wish them well and hope that one day we will fix those things. But I didn't really see myself as an environmentalist, and so I was finishing my degree in astrophysics, actually, planning on a career in observational astronomy, when I needed an extra course to finish my degree, and I looked around, and there was a couple of different classes I could take, and I saw this new class on climate science over in the geography department. So I thought to myself, well, that looks interesting. Why don't I take it? So I did, and I was completely shocked for two reasons. The first reason is because it turns out that climate science is the exact same physics, and even sometimes the same astrophysics, that I had been learning. I don't know what I thought it was, but I didn't think it was physics. But the second thing, and what really changed my life and my own trajectory, is that I recognized that climate change is what the U.S. military now calls a threat multiplier. In other words, the reason we care about it is not because anybody really cares about a 1 or 2 or 3 degree increase in the average temperature of the planet. It's because it takes all of the other issues that we already care about today and it exacerbates them, amplifies them, makes them worse. In Iowa, we're concerned about the increase in heavy rainfall that accompanies a warmer world. We're concerned about more extreme heat waves in summer. Where I live in Texas, people are worried that hurricanes are not getting more frequent, but they're getting a lot stronger and bigger with a lot more rainfall associated with them. And in California, of course, wildfires are a natural part of the ecosystem, but they're burning nearly double the area now than they would without a changing climate. So recognizing that climate change is not just an environmental issue, it's not even just a science issue. Climate change is a health issue, it's an economic issue, it's a national security issue, it's a human issue. that's what led me to change my trajectory, because as a human, I care not just about my future and that of my family, but I care about others, especially the poor and the vulnerable in this world who are disproportionately affected by those impacts here and on the other side of the world.
In studying climate change, how strong do you feel our understanding is at this point of how dramatically we have affected the planet?
Well, as scientists, our understanding is pretty complete at this point, in terms of we have never seen this much change this fast as far as we can go back in the paleoclimate record, which is millions of years. We also know that over the course of human civilization, we have definitely never seen this amount of change. And that's why it matters. It matters because of us. Will the planet survive? Of course, the planet's seen more extreme conditions in the past. Will we survive? That's the question. Our civilization, our water resources, our agriculture, our food, our economy, our public services, even our political systems, they were all built and constructed and grew during a period of climate stability. You know, a few little ups and downs at the regional scale, but nothing big, nothing global. So the question is, are we able to adapt and prepare to such an unprecedented change that we've never seen in the history of human civilization on this planet?
It feels like so often we are seeing new reports about climate change, about how extreme climate change is becoming, about it happening more rapidly than we originally anticipated. And that feels a little bit separate from the kind of political conversations that people are having. So I guess I'm wondering, there are so many people who are so passionate about understanding climate change. How much work do we have left to do to understand climate change?
Well, we certainly still have a lot of work to do, because, again, we're looking at an unprecedented situation. And what each new study is telling us, whether it's showing us that sea level is rising faster than we thought, or the ice sheets are melting more quickly than we thought, or we're being impacted in new and different ways that we didn't even imagine before, what the science is showing us is that, if anything, we have underestimated the magnitude and the extent of the impacts of a changing climate. So when we look to the future, when we look at our climate models, I often hear from people, especially on social media, saying, oh, those climate models, they're so biased. And I say, well, first of all, I evaluate climate models, so my job is to find the problems, and I'm very aware of the problems they have. But what many people don't realize is, when we evaluate our understanding of the physical climate system as encapsulated by our huge global climate models, we understand that, if anything, over scales of years to decades, the models run pretty true. They track observations pretty well. But when we start to look out into the future with a lot of question marks, a lot of unknowns in terms of this unprecedented and inadvertent experiment we're conducting with the only home that we have, if anything, when we compare our models to what happened in the distant past when we did see conditions that were as warm as today, we know that we're likely underestimating the impacts. So if anything, we are likely biased in really the wrong direction, which is to underestimate. And that's never the way you want to be biased.
So as you are looking at the science of this and understanding the science of this, why do you think this disconnect has happened? Why did people reject the science? Why are people actively rejecting the science on a daily basis?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the answer, or sorry, that's the question that social science can help us answer. And when you look at the number one factor in the United States that predicts whether we agree with science that dates back to the 1850s, telling us that climate is changing, humans are responsible, and today we know that the impacts are serious. The number one predictor of whether we agree with that fundamental science, which is the same physics that explains how our refrigerators work, how stoves heat food, and how airplanes fly, that is how basic the physics is. The number one predictor of whether we agree with that is not how much science education we have. It is not how smart we are. It is simply where we fall on the political spectrum. That is it. But as I said before, you know, a thermometer doesn't give us a different answer depending on where we fall on the political spectrum. So is it truly the science people have a problem with? No, it isn't. I've had thousands of conversations, and usually within somewhere between 30 to 90 seconds. That conversation that begins with, it's just a natural cycle, or you scientists are fudging the data to line your pockets with government grants. That conversation takes an abrupt right turn into, I don't want the government to, and then fill in the blank with a perceived solution that we see as contrary to our identity and our political ideology. So the most effective thing we can do to actually have a positive, constructive conversation about a changing climate is not hit people over the head with the science, but rather talk about solutions. The fact that Iowa is a leader in wind energy and it is bringing a tremendous number of jobs to the state. Now in Texas, we still have a slight edge, so a little healthy competition might be good there. But talking about personal solutions, talking about statewide solutions, talking about economic solutions, sharing the fact that China has more wind and solar energy than any other country in the world, they are beating the pants off the U.S. in the new clean energy economy. They're actually shutting down coal-fired power plants. They're flooding coal mines and putting floating solar panels on the water. People don't know these things. And when you think about the fact that energy is what powers our economy and China is leading the world in new clean energy, 70% of new energy installed around the world is clean energy, not old fossil fuels, we recognize that we actually have a lot more in common maybe than we thought if we are concerned about the future of our economy, of our competitiveness, of our technology, and ultimately our own welfare.
In Iowa, we have a kind of paradox, and that is that people who work in agriculture are really on the front line of climate change. They are seeing it and experiencing it in very real ways, season to season, year to year. A lot of people who work in agriculture also fall on the right side of the political spectrum and don't want to call what they're experiencing climate change. Harvest Public Media did some really interesting reporting about that. Is it important that we get people to accept that climate change is real to be able to work toward solutions, or is that a false fight?
I think it's a false fight.
I'm talking with Catherine Hayhoe, an atmospheric scientist who studies climate change. She'll be in Iowa this week in Cedar Falls at the University of Northern Iowa on Thursday, in Dubuque at the Growing Sustainable Communities Conference on Friday, and in Hiawatha at the Called to Climate Action Statewide Interfaith Gathering on Saturday. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm talking this hour with Catherine Hayhoe. She is an atmospheric scientist who studies climate change. She has served as a lead author for the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th U.S. National Climate Assessments. She hosts the PBS digital series Global Weirding, Climate, Politics, and Religion. And she's going to be spending a lot of time this week in Iowa. And Catherine, just before the break, we were talking about the question of whether or not you need to convince people that climate change is real to be able to work toward a solution. And you were saying that maybe we've set up sort of a false fight there, where we're just desperately trying to convince people that climate change is real, but that's not that useful.
Sometimes it's more important to us to be right than to have a solution. And I think we really have to be willing to flip that around if we're going to move forward together. So I live in Texas, and I've had a lot of conversations with people. And I want to share just three of those conversations with you very briefly to kind of highlight exactly this point. So I was speaking to a group of producers and farmers about a changing climate and how it affects our food production, and some really positive solutions like biochar and smart agriculture practices and water conservation. And at the end, one man came up to me and he said, very honestly, I would like to agree with you because everything you say makes sense. But if I say global warming is real, then I'll have to agree with Al Gore, and I could never do that. So I said, you know what? Don't say global warming is real. Let's just agree on the solutions and we're good. Another time I was talking to a group of water managers, and I was talking all about climate variability and long-term trends, which is exactly what we're seeing. Without ever mentioning the words climate and change together, that's exactly what's happening. At the end of it, I'll never forget, this woman came running up to me and grabbed my hand. She said, that was great. I agree with everything you said. Those people who talk about global warming, I don't agree with them at all, but this makes sense. And then talking with a farmer who I noticed did not have any wind turbines on his land, as we do often here in West Texas and in Iowa, but his neighbor had some wind turbines. I said, is there a reason why you don't have any wind turbines? And I was expecting a diatribe against, you know, climate change, because he definitely was not on board with that idea. And he said, yes, there is a reason. I got on the list 2 years after my neighbor. I've been waiting for those wind turbines for 2 years. And I said, well, if you don't mind me asking, why do you want them? He's like, well, because the check arrives in the mail. No problem with that. I do not care what we think of climate change, as long as we're both on board with the idea that wind energy brings jobs, cleans up the air, reduces our water use, and oh, by the way, it also cuts our carbon footprint.
So often when we talk about solutions to climate change, we talk about ways that we are going to have to radically transform how we live. And a lot of times those conversations end up sounding like us talking about things that we need to give up to make things better. So that's what sets people off in your estimation?
Yeah. Sure. A lot of what we hear in the conversation is we as individuals need to, and then people, you know, fill in the blank of their favorite solution that they're doing that they think everybody else should do. It's almost like a form of new religion. You know, if everybody's vegan like me, we could fix this problem. If everybody only has one child, we could fix this problem. If everybody, you know, stops driving, we can fix this problem. But instead, we need to understand that there are solutions that benefit us all. And certainly eating lower down the food chain and smart transportation is a big part of the solution. But agriculture is actually a huge part. So sustainable grazing practices, biochar, which is burning agricultural waste and plowing it back into the soil where it fertilizes the soil as well as sequestering the carbon in the land, smart and regenerative agricultural practices, no-till and others. There's a lot of things that farmers can do to not only improve the quality of their land and their crops, but to help us fix this thing. Farmers are a huge part of the solution.
If farmers are going to embrace those changes, though, they have to see that they are good for them.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I'm so glad that Iowa State and other universities in Iowa, through their extension program especially, are doing so much good work with local farmers and producers to test out many of these solutions and actually see how they work in Iowa, because there have to be multiple benefits. You can't just do it to save the world. You need to do it to help yourself too.
Do you feel like, let's just focus on agriculture for a moment, which I know is not your area of expertise, but it's something that affects so many of us here in Iowa and everywhere. Do you feel like we can innovate enough in agriculture to make it a carbon neutral way of life and make that beneficial for the farmers too?
Well, there's certainly a lot of efforts looking at that. For example, they're actually looking at developing farm equipment that does not have to run off fossil fuels. That's one thing. For people who raise cattle, they're looking at ways to use the manure and the waste and the gas produced by the cattle as a local energy source. A lot of farmers, even all the way up in Illinois, which is, you know, a bit cloudier than Iowa, a lot of farmers are recognizing that by using just a small part of their land, 10 to 15% of their land, to put solar panels on them and selling the energy, they can actually make effectively the average yield of their land. They can grow their own crop insurance, so to speak. And we haven't even touched on things, like I mentioned before, like no-till and biochar and other agricultural practices where you can start putting carbon back in the soil, which would be of tremendous financial benefit to farmers if we had a price on carbon. And the interesting thing is that there's a bipartisan climate solutions caucus in the House. So half Democrats, half Republicans, who introduced a bill in November to the House to put a price on carbon, which means that there would actually be a financial benefit to smart agricultural practices that put carbon back in the soil, which is, again, something that is beneficial because it acts as a natural fertilizer.
Not long ago, I was watching a documentary about the early years of the automotive industry, and it's so striking to see the ingenuity and the innovation that was going on in Detroit at that time. You know, so many changes so quickly, so many big breakthroughs so quickly. And watching something like that, it makes me think, okay, you know, we are such an ingenious species. Why can't we innovate our way out of climate change. Do you feel like we can innovate our way out of climate change?
To a large extent. But on the other hand, just producing more and more and more is not necessarily the answer as well. So I think it's a combination of, in some cases, returning to practices that we used to do that we don't anymore. The whole idea of a stitch in time saves nine, and the cheapest energy is the energy that we save rather than using. The idea that some of the agricultural practices we're talking about are ones that have been practiced for hundreds of years in different parts of the world. They're not anything particularly stunning or new. But you have to couple that with the fact that we do have really cool new ways to get energy today. I mean, windmills are actually very old. They've been using them for centuries around the world. But we have much more high-tech wind turbines today. We have solar panels today. We have things like solar paint that you can paint a house with, and solar shingles that collect the sun's energy. We have innovative new ways to grow food. There's even things like, you know, Beyond Meat and Impossible Burgers and things like that. So we certainly have our share of innovation, but we also have tried and true methods that we've been using for, in some cases, decades, and in some cases, centuries, that help us to conserve our energy, conserve our resources, put nutrients back in the soil where they belong, sustain our land, continue to grow our food, and stop wasting so much. Because one of the most interesting things I learned was that if food waste were its own country, it would be the third highest emitter of heat-trapping gases on an annual basis behind China and the U.S. We throw out over a third of the food we produce, and we do not need to be doing that. So things like efficient refrigeration and just even looking at the portions that we serve and how we do our own personal shopping. I used to shop, you know, once every two weeks or so. I used to stock up the fridge and the freezer, and then there'd be stuff forgotten at the back that would end up going bad before we could eat it. And so changing my own personal habits, one of the biggest things I've done is make sure I go grocery shopping on a more regular basis. We eat fresher food, it's healthier, and we're throwing out a fraction of what we used to.
I'm talking with Catherine Hayhoe. She is an atmospheric scientist who studies climate change. And I want to talk a little bit about faith. One of the things that's bringing you to Iowa is the Called to Climate Action. It's a statewide interfaith gathering. And you have done a lot of work to talk to Christian communities about climate change. Tell me what drives that work for you.
Well, what drives it is the fact that I'm a Christian myself, and the reason why I'm a climate scientist is because I'm a Christian. So as we were talking at the beginning, I originally began my career in astrophysics, which is a fascinating field to be in. But when I learned that climate change was not only a threat multiplier that affects every aspect of our lives here on this planet, but the fact that it disproportionately affects the poorest and most vulnerable people in the world, at that point I felt like, how can I not help? Because I believe as Christians that we are called to care for and to love our neighbors. We are called to especially watch out for people who are poor, who are vulnerable, who, it talks about the widows and the orphans, people who don't have the resources that we do. And how could I, as a Christian, not accept this opportunity to display love to other people who are suffering today? And so as a Christian, that's what motivates my work. And it, when I see Christians in the U.S., and this is a very uniquely U.S. phenomena, I have to say, when we see Christians in the U.S. who are putting their political ideology ahead of what the Bible says, and who in fact are letting their political ideology write their statement of faith, and if it comes in conflict with the Bible, they're going with what politics says over what the actual Bible says. That just breaks my heart.
I've had conversations about climate change with evangelical Christians who have said to me, this is not our problem. This is in God's hands. And that's it's a place in the conversation that it's hard to go past. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that you've had that conversation. How do you respond to that?
Many times. Probably once a week for 10 years. So interestingly, our Global Weirding series, which you mentioned before, which is on YouTube, everybody can just Google Global Weirding and it will pop right up. Our most watched episode of all the episodes we've done is, what does the Bible say about climate change? And of course, the words climate change are not in the Bible at all, but the Bible has a lot to say. And again, in the very first chapter of the first book in the Bible, it immediately dispels the myth you just mentioned. It says God gave humans responsibility over every living thing on this planet. So, of course, God's in charge. That's what we Christians believe. But the Bible itself says that God gave us responsibility. And so people who say, oh, well, God's going to take care of it. It's like, no, you actually have to read the Bible. And God was very clear. He is handing over that responsibility to us. And when we have been given a responsibility, it says in the Bible, we have a duty to be responsible to fulfill it.
For people who have found themselves getting into arguments with loved ones, coworkers, friends, members of the congregation, and find themselves being pulled apart from people on the basis of different beliefs about climate change, what is your advice? How do you get past that? How do you bridge the gap?
Well, that's actually the topic of my TED Talk. So when they asked me to give a TED Talk, I said, I'd like to talk about the single most important thing that any single one of us can do about a changing climate. And they're like, oh, but we already have lots of talks on light bulbs and recycling. I'm like, no, that's not what I want to talk about. And by the way, they also have lots of good TED Talks on agriculture and soils and climate, which I encourage people to check out. I said, no, I want to talk about the fact that having a positive, constructive conversation about how climate change impacts us in the places where we live and what we can do to fix it in a way that is consistent and compatible with our values and our identity is the single most important thing that any of us can do. And that conversation, in order to be positive and constructive, it must begin with something that we both agree on and value, rather than beginning with something that we disagree on, as most of our conversations about climate change typically do. So if we don't know how to start it, just have a conversation with somebody about who they are, what they enjoy doing, what did they do this weekend, what are they really passionate about, what do they care about, and then 9 times out of 10, often more, we can connect the dots between the fact that people might care about winter sports or about birding, and those things are being impacted by a changing climate, people who care about hunting or fishing, people who care about the local economy, people who care about our water resources, or who are affected by the terrible floods that Iowa has experienced over recent years. We can connect the dots to how climate change already matters to us. We just didn't realize it. So we don't have to change who we are. In fact, who we are is already the perfect person to care. And that is a whole world of difference between approaching the conversation as you don't care because you're not the right type of person, which comes frequently with a side of judgment. You're not the right type of person, and that's a bad person or a negative person, as opposed to approaching the situation with, hey, you're a person who already cares about these things, and you just haven't connected the dots to why it matters and to what we can actually do that is positive and beneficial and entirely consistent with who we are and what we believe.
How do you prepare yourself for having that conversation? Because it's not, you know, it's not enough just to find that connection, the thing that you have in common. You have to then take the conversation farther. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you have to avoid some of those hot button phrases, buzzwords that just set people off.
Yes.
So how do you prep?
Well, the first thing to do is to become aware of how climate change is affecting us in the places where we live. Now, you don't have to be an encyclopedia and you don't have to be a scientist. You know, 2 or 3 talking points is the most you need. So, for example, our global weirding episodes, we have one for each region of the country. So if you listen to the one in the Midwest, you will learn in just a few minutes the major ways that climate change is affecting the places where we live. The U.S. National Climate Assessment offers a chapter for each region, as well as a chapter for water, agriculture, transportation, health, and more. So that's another great place that you can find online by Googling 4th National Climate Assessment. You can find more information there on how we're being affected. And also the media often has a ton of good information on how climate change is increasing our heavy rainfall, our flood risk, our summer heat. It's pushing a lot of invasive species and pests poleward. And we're seeing a lot of other changes in the places where we live.
It's hard to stay positive in the face of all those reports that keep coming out that are telling us more and more about climate change and how we're experiencing it every day. Do you feel optimistic about the future?
Well, you have to. You have to go out and look for hope. Otherwise, we are going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy of doom. I don't find that hope in the science. As you pointed out earlier, almost every new study that comes out shows that it's probably a bit worse than we thought. And I don't find that hope in looking at our politics either, which just remains deeply divisive at the federal level. But I do find it, looking at what's happening in individual cities, towns, businesses, organizations, individual people who really, truly are making a difference. The fact that here in Texas, 19.8% of our power on our Texas grid was wind and solar last year, and that's pretty high. The fact that my husband actually got us solar panels for Christmas, and they came from a company in San Antonio that took in oil patch workers who lost their jobs when the price fell, and they were being taken in because we have more jobs in solar energy across the country now than in coal energy. And the Museum of Coal Mining in Kentucky put solar panels on their roof because that was the cheapest way for them to get their power. So there's these good news stories, but we have to go out and find them. They don't come looking for us. And when we find them, we need to share them with people. On my Facebook page, I've noticed that whenever I share a good news story, as I did this morning, there are more likes and shares for that story than anything else I post. We all need that hope. We can share that hope with each other, and that hope is what is going to keep us from becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy of doom.
Catherine Hayhoe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Catherine Hayhoe, an atmospheric scientist who studies climate change. She'll be in Iowa this week, in Cedar Falls at the University of Northern Iowa on Thursday, in Dubuque at the Growing Sustainable Communities Conference on Friday, and in Hiawatha at the Called to Climate Action Statewide Interfaith Gathering on Saturday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.